Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Ladies and gentlemen, record geeks, retired plate spinners, and millennials who want to impress their parents with their record collections. Welcome to the RhinoCast podcast, brought to you by Rhino Records. Get ready for new releases, deep tracks, and conversations with your favorite artists and bands, and balloons for the kiddies. And now, your hosts with the most, Rich Mahan and Dennis the Menace.
This episode of the Rhino Podcast is part two of our conversation with the great Linda Ronstadt. Stick around. Hey, Dennis, we've got the second part of your conversation with Linda Ronstadt in this episode of the Rhino Podcast. What do you guys cover in this one?
Oh, man, this is a treat. This is kind of, to use a term that's used in films, it's kind of a biopic. We start in Tucson and we make our way through Los Angeles. And a lot of the stories that you're expecting to hear, you're going to hear them direct from Linda with no filter.
Gotta love that. I love music history like this. I just eat it up.
She does not lack opinions. She does not lack stories. And the energy with which they're told is just captivating. Not to mention, she is Linda Ronstadt. So to sit there and hear these stories firsthand and for the audience to hear them, it's a treat would be an understatement.
And you got to visit her at her house, correct, in San Francisco?
Yes, indeed. In San Francisco, with her cat at our side, I can't even describe how wonderful it was.
What was it like to walk into her house?
You know, when you knock on the door, your level of anticipation is incredible. And within milliseconds, I just felt like I was hanging out with a friend.
Oh, how cool.
She is rock and roll royalty, but she absolutely, positively doesn't act it. However, when she has something to say, she knows her stuff. And I'm not talking just singing. I'm talking technical and music and all sorts of really deep stuff. And that is why she is Linda Ronstadt. I alluded to this early on, but this is kind of what I figured out, and you'll either tell me I'm wrong or not, but there are very few artists that are interpreters of songs. And that's kind of what I came up with, is when I was really thinking about what you've done all this time, you took songs and you made them yours. You interpreted them. You know, Sinatra did that. You know, the number of people I can count on maybe both my hands that have taken so many songs and made them theirs and interpreted them. Do you buy that? Because you weren't a songwriter, right? You didn't write songs, but you certainly knew how to look at a song and you had some sort of internal clock that said, yeah, I want to sing this one.
It would be something that would resonate in me. There'd be a line or a verse that said exactly how I felt at the time. And maybe a week later, it'd be something else. Be about something else, but songs with images that you can keep generating, like tarot card imagery, it brings something out of your unconscious, you know. Bob Dylan does that.
Yes. And you talked about voicing. You used the word voicing. So can you describe for people what voicing is?
Well, in the chords, it's where you, like, you could have a D chord with a D on the bottom or on the top, or a chord with an extra note in it that isn't always there.
Like, certain things about your life are covered in a paragraph. Tucson growing up, really multicultural atmosphere. Tell me about that.
Oh my God, it was so multicultural.
Like the ultimate melting pot, right?
We had a big population of Chinese people who had fled the genocide in Mexico because they were starting to compete for jobs and women in Mexico. So they had this thing called the three-day trip to China where they would load up a bunch of Chinese people on the boat.
Wow.
Go out a day and a half from the port, dump them overboard, and turn around and come back. So they'd go 3 days out and come back. And they were doing that systematically through the Chinese community. So they fled for their lives, wound up in Arizona, where they started vegetable farms and markets. And then the next generation, they're all doctors and lawyers, and they were gone. They were the nicest people. I loved them. And then there were the Indians, the Yaqui, that had fled Mexican persecution also and genocide. And they lived up as an independent community. They never signed a treaty with anybody. They just were still doing what they've been doing for thousands of years. And then there were a lot of Mexicans, of which I was one, Mexican-Americans. And we had a really sturdy Jewish community. I love that more than here. You can get better delis in Tucson than you can get here.
I will vouch for that.
And there was a Greek population. It was everything, you know.
Okay, so you have this melting pot, and you're growing up, and when you turned on the radio...
Oh, the radio was wild open then, because there were all these Mexican stations we could get, and they were really great. They played all different kind of music. And then there were all these country western stations that played gospel, white gospel in the night and white gospel on Sundays. And then we'd get these R&B stations. They're called Race Records then. They play Race Records. And we could hear all that. That came from Louisiana and from XERB, Del Rio, Texas, XERF.
There was another station in Del Rio that Wolfman Jack was on.
Yeah, it was that was XERF.
It was?
Del Rio, Texas, yeah.
Wow.
XERB, and he came over to California at some point and went to XERB.
Right.
But we heard the Wolfman Man before he was, you know.
Before anybody knew who he was.
Yeah.
So you had Top 40. So all of this...
A lot of rhythm and blues we listened to.
Really? So tell me more about that.
Well, I loved the bird groups, like the Penguins and the Jays and the Orioles and I loved them. I loved doo-wop. I was literally just mad for doo-wop. You could get those stations that were really far away. You could get better reception at night when the other stations just signed off. So we'd stay up really late to hear them. Earth Angel was the first.
Earth Angel was the Penguins.
That was the first doo-wop record I bought.
Wow.
At Hey Señorita on the other side.
Okay, so doo-wop got into your head. And around the house?
We used to harmonize, my sister and brother and I. We'd sing doo-wop, we'd sing soap commercials, we'd sing anything that came into our heads. Because we could harmonize together.
Wow.
Very naturally.
Was there a moment that your parents realized that you weren't going to be leading the typical life?
Everybody sang in the family, so it wasn't considered as anything special. My cousins all sang. And well, you know, not professionally, but well, gifted amateurs, you call them.
But where was that sea change where you were, at what age did you go, you know, I'm not going to become an accountant. I'm not going to become a lawyer. I'm not going to become a...
As soon as I heard Joan Baez.
Tell me more about that.
Well, she killed me. She is responsible for launching a lot of singing careers, I think. Her focus was so clean and pure. And she was such a skilled musician. You know, she recorded this song called Mary Hamilton. It has 900 verses. It's just her and the guitar. And she keeps it interesting all the way through because she changes her, varies her guitar. She has incredible dynamics. She has, of course, that golden voice that's just beautiful. And a real purity of intention. And it was just shocking. When I heard that, I said, that's what I want to do. I want to, not what she was doing, but I want to do something that makes me feel like that.
What age did you realize you weren't going to, and I know you've moved back there, but what age did you realize that Tucson was too, I don't want to put words in your mouth. What was?
17. Tucson was just too confining. There weren't enough people that liked the kind of music that I liked. And I really loved folk music then. And there was a lot of it going on in Los Angeles. The Ash Grove was in full swing. You know, you could see all these people that I read about in Sing Out magazine, Pete Seeger and Ry Cooder. I mean, he's the first guitar player I ever heard when I went to Los Angeles. He's to this day my favorite guitar player alive.
Hey don't get a rhythm
when you get blues. Did you just hop in the car and show up in L.A.? Did you know anybody there?
I knew Bobby Kimmel, who had been our bass player. My sister and brother and I had a folk group called the New Union Ramblers. Sorry about that.
No, we don't apologize. Perfect name.
And we had a banjo player and a bass player, and he was the bass player. And he wanted to make more money playing music, so he went to L.A. and started working in little clubs. He was kind of like a blues player.
So you get to L.A., you knew him. Where did you move to? Where did you live? Were you in
Santa Monica?
You went to Santa Monica?
In Pacific Ocean Park.
Really?
Yeah.
All the way out west. So you weren't near Laurel Canyon or any of that?
No, I was on the beach in Santa Monica. We paid $80 a month for a darling little, you know, little wooden cottage from the turn of the 20th.
So how did you find your way into the scene at that time?
We went to the Troubadour. We went to the Trip, which was up on Sunset Strip. That's where I saw the Birds. We went to the Ash Grove. That's where I saw Rye. Rye was playing in a band with Taj Mahal. That was pretty good. So I just thought, oh, they got some really good players here. And I met Jackson Browne right away through a mutual friend. He was 17, I was 18.
Wow.
And he had written These Days. He played it for me, and I just was blown away. I thought, oh, they got good songwriters over here. Might as well stay here. Yeah, Kenny Edwards was a young guitar player that was hanging around the neighborhood. I don't know how Bobby met him. I think he met him at the Ash Grove because Kenny is still worked there. And he was an impressive guitar player. I mean, I'd never heard people playing like that in Tucson. But, you know, we just harmonized with what we had. I'd always sung harmony my whole life. I didn't think it sounded as good as I sounded with my brother and sister. But that we had a family blend for that, and they couldn't leave. My brother was working for the L.A. Police Department. My sister had three kids. So they stayed, and I went out.
And again, I'll let you tell the tale. In terms of how you came to Different Drum and Michael Nesmith, you heard a completely different version of it.
Yeah, I heard John Harrell sing it from the Greenbrier Boys.
Right.
I had no idea who Mike Nesmith was because I don't think the Monkees had happened yet, or maybe they had. Anyway, I just thought it was a song that John Harrell had found someplace, but I didn't know it was by Michael Nesmith. I just came in with the record to Nick Vinay, who was our producer at Capitol, and said, I think this is a hit song. And I really like it. I really liked what it had to say. I like the words, you know.
So you do Different Drum, and that's kind of a, you know, that kind of, it was like a top 40, fit right into the moment, right?
It didn't fit any particular category except pop music.
But where did you realize that it wasn't going to be that you weren't going to be a band, that you were going to be...
Well, I think when the Stone Ponies split up, I was kind of stuck playing the guitar. I'm not a great guitar player, but I could play C, G, and F, and I could move the capo. And with C, G, and F, I could play a lot of country songs. So I started singing Hank Williams songs.
Ah. And so...
Patsy Cline.
And so at that point, because again, we're talking... Let's kind of try to compress, say... 68 to 74, because that's a lot of time, right?
A lot of wandering in the wilderness.
But that's what's interesting, though, right? Because it was Silver Threads and Golden Needles, which was definitely... Name a few things that you remember between that, because when we say wandering in the wilderness, you were recording the whole time, but you must have had A&R people at Capitol going...
Nobody ever suggested songs for me. I could tell songs. I would love to have had somebody suggest songs for me.
Why do you think A&R people left you alone?
I don't know.
I mean, think
about
it.
Maybe I bit them on the leg. I don't know.
Maybe you did. What rare artist gets away without the A&R going, hey, Linda, here's a list of songs we want you to do on your next record.
It just didn't occur. It didn't happen. Bobby was writing a lot of the songs. They weren't that good, but he was writing them. You know, I started playing clubs myself as a single artist. And I remember going up to Woodstock and meeting Eric Kaz. And I'd already met Gary White, this other good writer, and Jerry Jeff Walker, and they turned me on to the McGarrigle Sisters. So I came home with all these songs and not a really sympathetic producer, you know. John Boylan tried to help me a little bit, but...
Tell me more about the not sympathetic producer. When you say not sympathetic, meaning that he didn't get what you were trying to do?
I didn't get what I was trying to do was the problem.
Oh, you couldn't get him to give you the sound.
I had an idea, but I couldn't quite pull it off. I didn't have the technique to pull it off. And he was trying to help me, but he was trying to help me in another direction.
So where was he taking you? Was he taking you bigger?
He would like take me into Muscle Shoals. My singing style is more influenced by Mexican music than anything.
Interesting.
My vocal production and my phrasing.
Back to Glenn and Don and those guys. Where did they fall into the mix?
Well, they came later. Let's see. Well, I remember I lived in Topanga Canyon. I had my album cover called Hand Sewn Homegrown in front of this little abandoned stone cottage that I wanted to live in. I had another hit. I had Long, Long Time as a hit.
Yep.
And that kept me going. And I went on a lot of television shows, which I hated. And then we played colleges because I had these two little hits. But it wasn't until You're No Good that I finally felt that I had arrived on the scene.
When did you know that your backing band was no longer going to be your backing band and that they were going to go on their own and suddenly become the Eagles?
Don and Glenn were rooming together. On my tour, I had Don and Glenn. They roomed together on the road because we couldn't afford a room for everybody, so everybody had to double up. And they started writing songs together. And they said, we like writing songs together, we like singing together, we're going to form a band. I said, great, we have some suggestions for the band, because I was dying to get Bernie Ledden back in the band. I said, well, while you're getting your songs together and getting a record deal and waiting for it to get released, I have gigs, so stay with me. I'll have a good band, and you'll be working on your project. So
their projects, yeah.
So we got Bernie Ledden and Randy Meisner. Yeah.
Randy Meisner, yeah.
Randy Meisner was John Boylan's idea, and Bernie was my idea. And they loved him. When we introduced him, they
clicked.
They sat down. Bernie had written Witchy Woman with Don. I think he and Don wrote that. They came over to my house. I was living with John David Souther. We went out to the movie so they could have some time alone. We came back, and they'd been singing in the same room all afternoon, a real resonant room. So they'd really gotten their voices tuned into each other, and they got their harmonies all organized, four-part harmony. And they sang Witchy Woman and went, oh, that's such a hit.
Ooh, witchy woman, see how.
And again, it's impossible not to go to When Will I Be Loved. Same thing. You were inspired. I'll tell you this, but then I want you to go further. You were inspired by the Flying Burrito Brothers version, not the Everly Brothers version. You didn't know from the Everly Brothers.
I forgot the Everly Brothers wrote it.
Think that part of your success is that sometimes the way you came to these songs wasn't the way that other people would have come to these songs, where they'd go, oh, I'll just redo. Because I mean, look, and my favorite songwriter of all time is Paul Simon. I will say that without.
Amen, sir.
Without a doubt. One of the things that's interesting is, you know, I mean, Simon and Garfunkel, they saw the Everly Brothers when they were in high school as Tom
exactly.
and Jerry, and they said.
But they didn't sound like them when they got finished trying to copy them.
That's the point.
Everybody copies, and you try as hard as you can to sound like that.
But you didn't
person.
Copy. That's my point.
Oh, I copied everybody.
Well, you sort of did, but you also came at the songs in a different way. Because you didn't always come at them through the Everly Brothers or come at them through the obvious place. You came at them through other versions, not the hit versions. Continuing the theme of coming at things, and I took French, I didn't take Spanish, so there's not a chance I'm going to pronounce this. You're going to pronounce it. But when you decided to introduce something different into the pop realm, that being, say, Songs of My Father, the
Canciones
right way.
De mi padre.
Thank you. I could never do that. I would.
Can't either. My tongue doesn't work today.
I would butcher it. 2.5 million copies.
I'll tell you, by that point, I wasn't even thinking about business. I just wasn't. I was so in love with music, and I wanted to sing it so badly. And I thought I could if I just could put some time in it with the right musicians. And they were really good to me, those guys. I went down to the band rehearsals in Los Angeles and rehearsed with this band, Los Camperos, De Naticano. Natikano helped me a lot. They'd tell me when I was going off the track. The rhythms are very hard to learn, but I did. Me importas tú, y tú, y tú, y solamente tú, y tú, y tú. Me importas tú, y tú, y tú, y nadie más que tú. Ojos negros, piel canela, que me llegan a desesperar. Me importas tú, y tú.
Based on the people you grew up with and the things you know, if all of these young pop artists who are just like, well, how come I can, there's only two types. Well, how come I can't get there, right? I persevere, yeah. I play clubs, I do open mic nights, and I can't get there. Or the ones that have the one hit and then it goes and it's gone. What would you say to them? What do you say about?
I think that they make clever records but not write good songs these days.
I saved this for last because everybody leads with this. They always lead with Parkinson's. It's like the first paragraph of every article is, okay, well, Linda hasn't sung for this long and she's doing this and she's doing this. So what do you really want to tell people about your life today and how things are? And
gee, I don't know. I live a really quiet life. I always thought I would travel and knit and sew and garden and when I retired. I can't do any of those things, but I can still read. That's nice.
What are you reading?
Linda Greenhouse's book about journalism.
Oh, so tell me about that.
Well, she's the best writer on the Supreme Court. She's written on the Supreme Court for the New York Times for years and years. She's really good, very precise. Yeah, and she's writing about attitudes of journalism, like whether journalists should be allowed to have an opinion, whether they should even vote in order to show that they're disinterested and that they're fair-minded.
Well, aren't these appropriate times for that discussion?
Yeah.
You know, when you wake up in the morning, there's still lots of things that drive you, obviously.
Well, the need to sleep and the need to drink tea is one of them. The need to feed the cat.
For people who are listening to this, and particularly people who might be discovering your music through this, you know, through all of these releases, for the first time, what do you want them to know? I don't want to go the Zen way, but what have you?
My involvement with music is first with my family because my nephews are professional musicians and they play. And they come over here and stay with me when they perform here, and I get to hear them rehearse in the living room. And that's fun. But I also work with this little cultural group called the Cenzontles. They're over in Richmond, across the bridge in Richmond, and they run about 300 kids through their little facility a week, ages 8 to 19. And they teach them how to really play traditional Mexican instruments, the jarana, the violin, the guitar, the jawbone. You know, they teach them all the percussions. They teach them Mexican music from all different regions, Yucatan, Veracruz. They were so good. I was out on the road with my big show at that time. And I know traditional Mexican dancing. They were good. And I know the playing, the rhythms are just wicked, you know. So I gave them the money to make their field trip, and we became friends since then.
Oh.
But I've introduced them to Ry Cooter, who just fell in love with them.
Wow.
Jackson Brown, who went and wrote a song with them, plays with them all the time now. David Hidalgo from the Los Lobos records with them on a regular basis. So if I could sing, I would be over there learning from those kids. That's what I would be doing.
Wow.
But I can still learn a lot from them. I can sing in my head, and I can listen to the rhythms and internalize them.
Faithless love, where did I go wrong? Was it telling stories in a heartbreak song? Where nobody's right and nobody was wrong. Faithless.
I really enjoyed your conversation with Linda. There's so much that she shed light on. I feel like I know so much more about her career and what made her the person that she is and the artist that she is now.
What you learn is this is a woman who earned everything that she got in her career, and she worked hard for it.
Live in Hollywood, her new and only live release is available now on CD, LP, and at all streaming outlets. And as always, folks, if you haven't already, please hit that subscribe button so you don't miss the next RhinoCast. Executive producers for Rhino, John Hughes and Lauren Goldberg. Produced for Rhino by Pop Cult and Rich Mahan Promotions. All rights reserved.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.